Welcome back to the course on Critical Theory, Cultural Studies, and Postmodern Theory, considered in terms of civil liberty. And so first lecture, in our first lecture, what we did is introduce the three schools, talked about their timelines and their, you know, basic orientation. And then in the second lecture, I introduced three of the precursors of the Frankfurt School, the major precursors, Hegel, Marx, and Lukács. So today we begin in earnest treating the school, the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, looking at their methodology, as well as two of their major theorists, that's Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer. But before I begin, I just wanted to post a bit of a note or a caveat about the approach being taken here. So basically there's two major approaches that you'll see with reference to these this group in particular, the Frankfurt School. Inside of academia, they're taken extremely seriously. They've had an enormous impact. Their influence has crossed many fields and disciplines into legal studies, critical race theory, and I'll talk about all that in the critical conclusions to the school. They've had an enormous impact since the 50s, and it's just increased over time, and it's even launched fields of study. But outside of academia, they're more or less denounced, dismissed, and hysterically raved about and ranted about and treated like the a group of serial murderers who came over to the United States just to wreak havoc on our civilization, to destroy Western society and civilization, etc. Now, neither of these two approaches are appropriate, I don't think. I think that a critical approach that actually evaluates what they had to say and then critically engages with them is the way to go about it. So let's begin with a treatment of their methods. The main method here is called Kritik, or Kritik in German. This is the central concept of the school and all of the thinkers. And so what do they mean by Kritik? What does criticism or critique mean here? Well, let's talk about that. So Kritik, it seeks to relate the subject of observation, that is the human knower, and their judgment, to the objects of knowledge and observation or judgment, and then to relate them in a dialectical process. In other words, they see the subject-object relationship as dialectical, and they hope to maintain that dialectical relationship for their purposes, and we'll see what those are. Okay, so they not only seek to comprehend the objects of knowledge or what their objects of study are, but also to comprehend the subject-object relationship itself, and then further, to transform that, because these are not merely philosophers. These are critics, and their criticism is meant to change things. It follows after Marx's axiom. So far, philosophers have only sought to understand the world. What really needs to be done, and I'm paraphrasing, is to change it. So that's exactly how they follow, right in line with that line of inquiry and approach. So critique seeks to grasp the totality of individual and social life, as well as the social processes that constitute them. So this was a very ambitious idea, to grasp basically all of social reality itself and to understand the relationships between the elements in the social world, like the individuals with each other, the classes with each other, the individual's relationship to nature, etc. Now, it should be noted that they think the totality is the determining factor, that is, the whole makes up the parts and actually determines what they are. So the constitution of the individual or the class or whatever is understood in terms of the social totality that makes it up. To put this in terms of Immanuel Kant, one might argue that critique seeks to grasp the thing in itself, that is, the noumena, as Kant put it, that is, the actual reality of an object world, as opposed to the thing as it appears, or the phenomenal world. critique seeks to grasp the inherent relationship between thought and action. And I could add here between theory and practice, as they would put it, or praxis, as it's often called, P-R-A-X-I-S. The idea here is that they want to understand the relationship between thinking and doing, between theorizing and activism and action. So they want to understand how theory impacts action, how thought impacts action, how theory impacts activism. Critique seeks to put the subject and object of knowledge in a dialectical relationship. So this goes back to the dialectic of Hegel, as imported by Marx and maintained throughout this entire course so far, that these thinkers have all thought and sought to maintain this relationship between the subject and the object world in a dialectical relationship, one of mutual reciprocity. So one of the keys here is that the Frankfurt School sees much of Western knowledge as collapsing the subject into the object. And I'll talk about that a bit further. Critique seeks the transformation of the subject as a result of this deepened knowledge of the object. And here you have to keep in mind the notion of ideology. But before I talk about that, so they're looking at transforming the subject of knowledge and the subject of society. And of course, this is different than the orthodox Marxist view, which then, as I mentioned, places all importance on the object, on the object world, on the deterministic mechanism of change, which is determined historically by the means of production and so forth. It was all seen as scientific, etc. And the subject was basically, that is, the working class in the case of classes, was basically just treated as kind of like another object that operated within this larger object world. But now they're bringing back again this idea of an active subject who intervenes. So there was kind of an erasure of the subject's agency, a term that you could look up on the glossary that I've posted, and to see how that agency actually operates and what it can do with reference to society, the object world, etc. Critique seeks to grasp how the knowledge of the object is produced. How is knowledge produced? What is the epistemology? And to transform the object and subject as a result. So they're not only trying to know, it's not just science or philosophy. This is a theoretical school that aims to import philosophy and combine it with sociology. And sociology is still too descriptive, and also to combine it with this active element that intervenes and changes the world rather than just understanding it. Understanding is not enough. And don't forget that the object is revolution. So this brings me to the notion, just what is critical theory? What's the critical theory of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory? Well, critical theory was to be counterposed to traditional theory. And so what's the difference? What is traditional theory? Traditional theory was concerned, or is concerned, with merely a descriptive analysis of something, of society, of phenomenon, etc. So sociology discusses the social body and its various parts. It analyzes it and it describes it. But you don't, although it's becoming more the case lately, sociology was never meant to be a form of activism. It was meant to be a science. Of course, that's always been up for debate, and it still is. But sociology was founded by Auguste Comte to be a science of society, a science for discussing and treating society. Well, the critical theory of the Frankfurt School is against theory as strictly descriptive. They're interested in a normative, that is, a prescriptive approach to the world. Critical theory of society seeks explanation as well as the normative evaluation of what made the object of investigation problematic. In other words, They don't only seek to explain. They want to evaluate using values. So we have here a synthesis of facts and values, whereas science is thought by positivists, etc., to be value free. They make no pretension about their observations being value laden or saturated with values, and values are brought to the table to bear on what they're looking at. They also want to identify the agents that would be responsible for the transformation of society. Okay, so now, as I've mentioned, of course, in Orthodox Marxism and most Marxist schools, that is the working class. That is decreasingly the case as we move on through the Frankfurt School. So here are the two major theorists that we'll talk about today. Theodor Adorno, who lived from 1903 to 1969, and Max Horkheimer, 1895 to 1973. Let's talk about Horkheimer first. Horkheimer became the chair, if you will, of the Frankfurt School after it was founded. He ran it. He was its director, is the proper term. He's a major figure in that sense. He's less a major figure in the sense of being a high theorist and being regarded with as much esteem as the gentleman on your left, or my left anyway, and that is Theodor Adorno. Adorno is a heavyweight. I mean, he's considered a major heavyweight in the field, and they wrote together, but it's hard to say where Max Horkheimer came in, because Adorno was such a daunting presence and a major impact, with a major influence. So we're going to begin by discussing one of their major books, The Dialectic of Enlightenment, and then within that book, an essay called The Culture Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception. So right away we see the Enlightenment is going to come up for critical evaluation, which is something that I think that the Frankfurt School lends to, inaugurates, rather, and that is picked up by postmodern theory. The Dialectic of Enlightenment was published in 1947. So by then, these people were already in the United States, although Adorno had gone back to Germany, I believe, by then. So some of the major themes of this book, which is a very dense, difficult book. I remember in graduate school reading this book aloud. In a classroom, we would read a sentence each and then attempt as an entire class to explicate what that single sentence was actually trying to say or was saying. They made no bones about being impenetrable. It's incredibly dense. But we're able to glean from it these major themes. One, Enlightenment, which sought to eradicate myth, that is the myth of religion or mythos in general, it becomes myth. The Enlightenment becomes a myth in itself. So you'll notice in this treatment there are two ways that I represent Enlightenment. One is with a capital E and one with a lowercase e. The capital E represents the historical period and the process of Enlightenment that's actually happened. The lowercase e is Enlightenment as these theorists would have it, which they bring to bear against the Enlightenment, or Enlightenment itself, with a capital E. So Enlightenment, which sought to eradicate myth, becomes myth. Rationality, which was central to the Enlightenment, of course, which sought to dominate nature, or at least control it and understand it, comes to dominate humanity. These are major themes in the book. And that's a theme that rationality dominates, that it's oppressive and all that. That's obviously, you know, au courant in our time, but is majorly picked up by the postmodern theorists. Dialectic of Enlightenment theme. Another theme is reason of the Enlightenment, or Enlightenment, is split into two categories: critical reason and instrumental reason. The first one, which is good in their eyes; the second one, which is very bad. I'll talk about instrumental reason first. Instrumental reason is reason that is only used as a means to an end. So it's more like technology or the rationality that goes into technology. How do you achieve B? How do you achieve a particular end? You do X, Y, Z. It's a means to ends type of analysis or reasoning, which they deplored. We'll talk about why. Critical reason, on the other hand, is reason that maintains a dialectical relationship between the human subject and the object world. Because, see, what they were saying about the Enlightenment is that what happened was, in its passive study of nature and the world, Enlightenment ends up collapsing the subject of knowledge into the object world, and he disappears in it, becomes nothing, becomes a part of the object, and thus becomes an object, him, her, or itself. So, critical reason aims at maintaining this relationship of separation between the subject and the object, so that the subject maintains its autonomy while the object is not dominated or exploited or what have you. With the instrumentalization of reason comes domination. Domination of what? Of humanity over nature. So they look at, you know, the way technology has plundered nature and so on and so forth. Of humanity over its own nature. So I already referred to that, the way that this instrumental reason is seen as dominating the very person who engages in it. And then of humans, some humans over others. So the way that, you know, Western imperialist science and technology has dominated different parts of the world. So reason is seen right here and now as this very dominating force, but it's critical reason is exempted from this. This is instrumental reason. So unlike the postmodernists who condemn all of reason, at least these theorists leave some kind of reason that is not implicated in evil, to put it mildly. Reason, which was supposed to liberate humanity, ends up with Enlightenment dominating humanity. So, you know, reason was meant to be a means of liberation. It was meant to take control over the world so that we would be freed from its hostile and, you know, hostility, its difficulties, and the more we gained technology, the more mastery we had over nature, the less we were subject to its conditions, the aleatory conditions of weather and geography and other things, you know, hunger and what have you. If we could control nature through technology, then we'd be liberated through science and technology. Well, they see this as turning back against the human and actually dominating him, so that everybody is under the domination of technology. Reason thus has become irrational. So what was supposed to be reason and rationality is irrational as they see it. And the irrationality of reason is that as a supposed means for liberation, it becomes a ruthless domination. The domination of humanity by reason is a piece with capitalism, of course. Here we go. Which is Enlightenment's ultimate expression. So they do see capitalism as the ultimate expression of Enlightenment rationality. That is, it's about using reason to capitalize, to profit, to control resources, also to control people, the working classes, to control other nations and lesser developed countries, and so on and so forth. Thus, Adorno and Horkheimer argue for the enlightenment of enlightenment. So here we have the lowercase e, enlightenment. That is, they want to re-enlighten, or actually enlighten for the first time, enlightenment. They think that it needs or enlightened for the first time. What do they mean by that? Well, the demythologizing of enlightenment is mythological in itself. Okay, what does this mean? Enlightenment was thought to demythologize nature, demythologize life, to bring it under rational consideration and control. And it was thus, you know, to get rid of religious myth and so forth, and to replace it with positive knowledge. Well, they think that very story of enlightenment is itself a myth. That story that the Enlightenment or enlightenment has done that is a myth in itself. That's a story that has to be abolished. So the enlightenment of enlightenment, to enlighten enlightenment, is a demythologizing of enlightenment mythology, to eradicate the mythology of enlightenment as such. The image of enlightenment as liberating, as enlightenment, is illusory. They argue that, you know, the great praise that's bestowed on enlightenment by the West, especially, is really as a liberating and incredibly wealth-producing in terms of economics, in terms of politics, freedom-producing, and democracy-producing, in terms of science and technology, knowledge-producing, etc. They see this as illusory. This is not really what happened. So the demythologizing of enlightenment means to destroy the image of enlightenment, as liberating. And they tried to do it. They spent 300 pages attacking enlightenment. In general, dialectic of enlightenment is a negative critique of modernity as barbarism. They point, you know, endlessly to the horrors of Western civilization, particularly the Holocaust, World War I and II, the existence of the nuclear bomb, the beginning of the Cold War, the plundering of colonies and other lesser nations, and so on and so forth. So the power of reason turns back on the reasoning subject and dominates, if not destroying him. So reason is actually, it has a boomerang effect, meant to control others, meant to control nature. It ends up controlling man. A negative dialectic, they suggest, must replace the positive reinforcing effects of domination. So again, here we go with this notion of negation. Negation is the key, negating the so-called positive effects of domination. A negative dialectic negates the positive domination of enlightenment. So those features that I just discussed, a negative dialectic is a critical reason that aims to negate what is the forms of domination that have arisen from enlightenment. In the final analysis, we should say that the dialectic of enlightenment, or dialectic of enlightenment, that's the book, is a negative, pessimistic work that sees Western society as one of technological domination over nature, others, and humanity itself. So I'm going to go into a little bit further, but one of the things they saw here was that fascism and Nazism and other forms of totalitarianism, like Soviet communism, which they barely mentioned, by the way, they see these as following directly from enlightenment. So believe it or not, they see fascism as a natural outcropping of enlightenment rationality. Especially instrumental rationality. And you might point to the way technology was used to count the Jewish prisoners and Holocaust victims, but, you know, IBM's punch cards and so on and so forth. You could point to all these things. These are what the kind of things they're referring to. That they see this as a natural extension of enlightenment rationality as practiced. Again, there's very little criticism of communism, despite the leaks and so forth about the horrors that happened there or were going on. Now I'm going to go into one of their major essays within the book. It's called The Culture Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception. So this book is more or less a compendium of essays. They're all related thematically, but they're not. It's not like there's a progress from one essay to the other. It's pretty much standalone pieces. This one in particular is a standalone piece. It's inaugurated an entire discipline. Media studies really came from this essay. So media studies has this grounding. So when you hear the words media studies, you'll know where it's coming from, or what the premises are, what its beginnings are, what its origins are, and what its outlook is, in effect. Okay, so In this essay, the authors argue, and it's the same authors, Theodore Dorner and Max Horkheimer, that the culture industry, that's what they call mass media, like all other industries under, quote, late capitalism, which they refer to as, you know, that's how they refer to capitalism, and that's kind of a wistful, hopeful way that Marxists talk about capitalism, late capitalism, as meaning that it's, you know, its end is near. They see, go back here, the culture industry, like all other industries, is an industry. That's the key, that they think that mass media, etc., is an industry, that it's just like other industries, and it's mass-producing its objects. So what does that do? Well, they have a kind of arts and crafts standpoint with reference to mass production. We'll get into that here. By means of mass production, cultural products lose their character as art, of being art. So this is a typical high-modernist-sounding criticism. It sounds like, in a way, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, about the cultural wasteland of mass culture. This was a typical trope of what might call elitism from the modernists, but they're coming at it from a different angle. Whereas the modernists, like Eliot, faulted the actual masses for their own lack of taste and cultural refineries and cultural knowledge. These theorists will levy their attack at the system that's producing the goods and not the consumers as such, although they see them as dominated by this, by mass cultural industry. Culture thus serves to reproduce the conditions of late capitalism. So, I'll talk about what do they see going on with mass culture. The audience has become replicas of the system. So what they're saying here is that what we understand as entertainment to them was a form of programming, and it is called programming, so that's interesting. But the programming is not of the shows, it's of the people that are viewing the shows or listening to the shows or whatever. And they saw this as a means that capitalism reproduced itself by reproducing, first of all, the working class at the point of production. So leisure was not simply something for the workers to relax by and, you know, become distracted from. No, it was a way of formatting the consciousness. It is a means of formatting the consciousness of the collective. The audiences thus become replicas. They become walking, talking replicas of the system. They're purely indoctrinated now. They're indoctrinated into capitalist ideology. That's the idea. The most important yield of the culture industry is not the cultural products themselves, but rather the formatting of the leisure time and thereby the consciousness of the consumer producer. So this is just a way of reproducing the labor force as a compliant, complicit, obsequiously, you know, obeisant labor body that can be molded in the hands of the capitalist class. So basically they're saying that this programming that goes on that people are watching is working hand in glove with the working, the production that these people do during the day or night, or whatever their schedule might be. Okay, it should be noted, this is a conclusion to conclude the discussion of Dorner and Horkheimer. We should note, of course, remembering here that Adorno and Horkheimer begin with the premises of Marxism. Okay. They saw the consumerism of Western society as especially in the U.S., where they moved to, as I said, from Germany, as a sign of capitalism's success, which, of course, they interpreted as Marxism's failure, and thus as necessarily pernicious. So the beneficence, all the munificence, I should say, of, you know, the wealth of goods, and the fact that some workers were driving the same car as their bosses, for example, or watching the same TV shows, or in this case, radio programs. There weren't TV shows yet, or films. they're consuming the same products, this was a disaster for them, because this was a sign that the working class was not to be located in culture and society. Where were they? So consumerism is not seen as a sign of something good, that, look, more people are getting goods than ever before. The average income and wealth of the workers has increased dramatically, especially since the late 18th century. You can even, the graph is an enormous increase in wealth for the plebe, if you will. But this was terrible for in their eyes. This was just a sign that what? That the worker and the working class was being incorporated into the system. And therefore, they were no longer effective as an agent for Marxist revolutionary activity. Adorno and, by extension, Horkheimer became primarily armchair Marxist philosophers and social critics. I want to say that because it's real hard to say that these people destroyed Western civilization, because in the end, Horkheimer and Adorno, especially Adorno, his work was so obscure and largely impenetrable. And in the end of his life, he wrote mostly about music. He was a music critic. It's hard to argue that he was creating the kind of devastation that is often accorded to the Frankfurt School. He's not an activist at all. As a matter of fact, when the 1968 rebellion took place in Europe, especially France, he was horrified by it. He thought it resembled fascism to him, like he probably would now if he saw the rioting and stuff going on here. So this guy is not leading the charge by any stretch. He's already given up hope in the working class as the agent of change, and he's basically retired into his den with a pipe, smoking a pipe and writing about, you know, music. He hated jazz, and he wrote about classical music. And as I said, the impenetrability of his work really limits its reach and appeal. Just pick up the Dialectic of Enlightenment, or Dialectic of Enlightenment, and see how far you get. No offense to you, it's not readable. Later, his career became one of more trenchant and pessimistic criticism. He becomes very, he doesn't see much hope, and it's kind of like a reclining negativity, which is really their method. His views did not lead to any mass action, but rather helped to cultivate a negative attitude toward the successes of quote-unquote late capitalism. So if he did anything, indeed, he helped to promote a negative attitude towards the success of late capitalism, as they would call it. To keep a critical, negative, dialectical viewpoint afloat. That was his, really his main role. And if anything came from him that we would think of as pernicious, that would be it. The Frankfurt School's impact, however, would be felt more tangibly through the work of another Frankfurt School theorist, and this more practical theorist, whom we will discuss next, is Herbert Marcuse. So that's it for today's lecture, and we will see you at lecture 4.